3:25, 12:27, 12:45, 5:25, 8:16, 8 o'clock, 3:44. Times, all times in the morning. What's so important about them? There is one person in this room, besides myself, one person in this room who remembers them very distinctly, passionately, painfully. They are the times of birth of my sons. Irritating bunch, aren't they? Turning up at early hours of the morning. They are the times that my sons were born. Sometimes, stick in our memories, births, marriages, deaths, they lock in our heads. But of course, the clocks of our lives are not always so precise as 3:25 and 12:27. We have other clocks in our heads as well, other clocks in our memories that have deep meaning for us, but they're not so precise. It happened during that hot summer. It was just after I turned 18. Mark 15 has a mix of both. Mark tells us times in our verses, doesn't he? The third hour, the sixth hour, the ninth hour. But he's not wearing a watch. And actually, the times aren't as precise as my son's births are. Rather, they're more about the pattern that Mark sees in them. A pattern of time which is taking place, and a pattern which Mark highly values as memorable. The pattern of three. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to talk through the verses from 25 to 33, not all the way to 39, we'll stop at 33. And then secondly, I'm going to talk about the number three. And then really, I should have a third point, because that would be really impressive, because it would be three, and I didn't come up with one. So we're going to do it in two. So let's divide the story. Let's dive into the story. Let's go into verses 25 onwards. Mark tells us his first time reference. It was the third hour when they crucified Jesus. This is probably the third hour since sunrise, which we think means it's about 9 o'clock in the morning that the Lord is being nailed up. However, if you know John chapter 19, you'll know he refers to the sixth hour, which shows the two writers were not working with synchronized watches, or in other words, they were not thinking of time in the same way that we do. Anyway, Jesus has been up all night, and he is now in a very bad way. He has been horribly abused physically. You remember in the previous verses all the beatings around the head? You think of what that would do to you? And psychologically, he has been bullied, he has been threatened, he has been mocked. The soldiers are now nailing him up. They're going to nail him, I believe it's through the wrist. You can't really do the hand because it will tear too easily or whatever. I think it's the wrist. But anyway, he is going to be nailed hands and feet, as it were, to this cross of wood. If you remember, probably the vertical beam is already out in the ground, or at least available there. The horizontal has been carried through the streets, but not by him, by this man Simon, because Jesus is too weak. They nail him, they lock it into the ground. He's going to hang here now. Till dead. Potentially it will take a while. The cross didn't kill you quickly. It made you suffer great agony in public. You would struggle to breathe because of the whole pressure that you have. If your arms are like this, you'll probably at some point suffer a heart attack. And he's going to die as the sun is rising and becoming hotter and hotter on him. Well, maybe. though God does something else during the morning. Verse 26, it says there's a written notice of the charge against him. It reads, the king of the Jews. This is probably over his head. And he will have carried it through the streets, almost certainly, as the indication of why he was going to be crucified, saying why he must die. The Roman authorities were declaring him a rebel. He was trying to overthrow the legitimate authority. He was claiming to be a king in this country. Well, this king is going to die. But I'm sure the governor and soldiers enjoy the mockery of it as well. I'm sure it's funny to them that here is this broken man carrying this little sign saying, King of the Jews. A mockery of the Jews themselves, who they rule over. Oh, so this is the sort of king you produce. How very impressive. Verse 27, he's not alone. They crucified two robbers with him, one on his right and one on his left. Robbers, bandits, could be terrorists. The language is such that it may mean that even these are two guys from Barabbas' gang. That's entirely possible. We obviously already know that Barabbas was captured because Pilate offered him to the crowd. Presumably when they took Barabbas, they took other members of the group. These two men could be from that group. Certainly these are violent men who have been captured by the authorities and they're going to be put to death too. And there's one each side of him. For those of us who have been following in Mark's Gospel, our minds will track back to chapter 10. Back in chapter 10, you had these two excitable young men, James and his brother John. And they came to Jesus and said, we were with you on the Mount of Transfiguration. We saw you with Moses and Elijah. You're coming to Jerusalem, the great Mount Zion. You're going to come into glory. And we're not quite sure what that's going to be because you talk about this dying and rising thing. But can we be on your left and right? Can we be at your side? Can we be the big three? Jesus' reply, unsurprisingly, was, you haven't the faintest idea what you are asking. Do you think you can cope with the glory I'm expecting in Jerusalem on the mountain? And now here it is. Jesus hanging up in shame at Jerusalem. Slandered as a leader of bandits. Verse 29, he's in a public place. Those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, so, you who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, come down from the cross and save yourself. These are just passers-by. And they're mocking him. The lies from Jesus' trial have been passed around. Whether they were already known or whether they've been leaked. Whatever the case is, they've spread. Oh yes, this is Jesus. Do you remember? He claimed he was going to destroy the temple. He said it in public in terms of talking about the temple and its judgment. So maybe people have got it from there. But whatever's the case, oh yes, he said he was going to destroy the temple. Said he was going to destroy it in 3 days. Then he was going to rebuild it. Some sort of miracle man. Well, Jesus never did put it that way. Never did claim he was literally going to knock down the stone temple in 3 days. But people have heard it. Maybe they remember Mark 11. There, you remember he went into the temple and drove out the traders. He went into the temple and said, worship here is no worship at all. Nothing of value is occurring here. I don't want poor people coming into this temple and paying good money to do something so valueless. And he drove all the traders out. And then he said, this place, how can I describe it? How about den of robbers? The word robber is the same word as these guys hanging next to him, bandits. He said, all I see here is a safe house where people who are up to no good think they can run and hide. You call this a place of prayer? There's no prayer going on here. No one's talking to God. Maybe people remember that. He certainly said that about the temple. He's clearly right as well, isn't he? And you look at this scene, and you look at these passers-by, and you think of what's happened in the hours earlier through that night. What is Jerusalem at this point? It's the city where Passover's going to be kept. What is Jerusalem at this point? A place where a load of troublemakers live, like Barabbas, or die, like the two on the crosses. Where a righteous man who's done no wrong can be condemned in a few hours and be dead a few hours later. Jesus, slandered as a bandit, because that's what people expect in Jerusalem. You expect your good rabbis to turn out to be bandits after all. That's the sort of place it's become. It's a horrible thing, isn't it, when a society or a particular organisation or something reaches a point where everybody ends up suspicious of everybody, where nobody can have a good reputation. I mean, I know people have, you know, gone through things like, the safety training in, you know, an organisation, a charity or whatever that deals with children. Yeah, and they come out saying, it's like I have to be suspicious of everybody because at any moment anybody could be doing something they shouldn't be doing to a child. You know, my colleagues and just anybody who walks in, and I feel like I have to be suspicious of everyone until proven otherwise. It's horrible when you live in an environment where it feels like that, constant suspicion. But that's what Jerusalem's become. Jesus walked into that temple and he just said, this place gives me the chills. It's bandit territory. And these people laugh at him. Oh, you said the temple had to fall to save it and us. Yeah, that's pretty much right, actually. I think it does. But they laugh. Ha! Where's that now? You're pinned to a cross. Save yourself! Hopefully you're not surprised that in another gospel we're told that Jesus just burst into tears when he saw Jerusalem. He just cried. It's corrupt, it's perverted, it's criminal. The whole thing is sad. Jesus would say, wouldn't he, to his fellow citizens about how society's become blind to what they actually are. Individuals can do the same. They just don't see what they are. We become so certain we're right. Like this person walking past Jesus, laughing away. Ha! So funny what you said. So certain they're right, and that he's wicked, and that he's stupid. So blind to reality. We can do it. We can become people who are quick to condemn others with limited or no evidence, whilst we fail to see ourselves. The Lord warned us, don't judge others until the huge plank of pride is out of your eye. It's natural to sinful people like us to look at others in a way that makes us feel better. So we're not thinking of them truly as they are. We're being driven by our own pride. It's so easy for us to look at others so we can feel superior. Ha! The great rabbi with all those people who followed him, now on a cross. What an idiot. The ordinary person in the street walking by. Ordinary people like us. Covetousness is common. we must be careful. Societies and individuals, before they assess and judge others, should look at themselves, humble themselves. If you do that, then you'll start to look at your faults and sins, that you would deal with them. And then, and only then, are you prepared to see where others go wrong and try to help them. You have to face yourself first, said Jesus. Lose the pride. Then you can help others to see where they've gone wrong. But Jerusalem at this moment, so proud, failing to look at herself. Jesus is mocked by the passers-by. But then the leaders laugh at him. In the same way, the chief priests and the teachers of the law mocked him among themselves. He saved others, they said, but he can't save himself. Let this Christ, this King of Israel, come down now from the cross that we may see and believe. Mocked him among themselves. What a picture, eh? That sordid little gossip circle that you get, where people are all together and they start to talk and someone comments on somebody outside the group and everybody starts to giggle and laugh and stories are told and everybody stays there and there's a couple who are particularly vocal and they make the jokes, but everybody else is stood there quietly listening, doesn't walk away, doesn't say, hang on, stop, don't. There they are, all mocking. What a joke, can't save himself. Two things to note in their comments. Number one, they say he saved others. What a thing, eh? They actually admit what he did. They can't deny the help he gave to so many. They can't deny that he humbly put others first. He tired himself out showing gracious love. That there was no plank of pride in his eye. I mean, that is the sickness of human sin, isn't it? That you can mock one who has done good. He saved others, and they don't then shut up and go, gosh, he saved others, wow. So, yeah, first thing to note is they admit he saved others. Second thing to note is how obnoxious it is for them to behave as they do, therefore. To deride the man who cared for Israel. This is the nation they claim to lead. They claim to live for Israel's greater glory. Here is a man who has helped many Israelites. And they laugh at him. He's done what they have never done for the people. But their pride, it's so powerful that all their failure to help and save is hidden away by laughing at him, even though they have to admit that he did help. It's so evil, it's so dark. And it's why they miss the fact that, in fact, hanging on this cross, he is undertaking the greatest act of help of all. He is saving right in front of their eyes. He saved others, but he can't save himself. Well, no, that's because he's saving others, actually, and you're not seeing it. He does it by dying. They should be awestruck, really, shouldn't they, at his sacrifice, but their stupid little brains don't see it, and neither would ours, if we'd been there. You are the Christ, they say to him, the anointed one, the King of Israel. Come down now from the cross that we may see and believe. Oh, you told us in the council that you come from God. You told us when we that you told us you were going to judge us. Well, prove it. Get off the cross. If these elders had actually listened to him in their courtroom, they'd have understood what was happening right now. When Jesus spoke to them in their courtroom, he was echoing Daniel 7. He talked about the Son of Man coming on the clouds of glory. Well, Daniel 7 was a longer prophecy than just that. Daniel 7 is a prophecy that speaks of a great empire, a human empire, that crushes God's holy people. And seems to be winning over them until God overturns it and gives a new empire to the Son of Man with all the authority of heaven at his disposal. If their eyes and hearts were open, they would see that on the cross, Daniel 7 is coming true before their very eyes. Here is the Son of Man. Jesus didn't hide it. He called himself that all the time, including in the courtroom. Here is the Son of Man being crushed by a brutal Roman Empire, but he has said that he will rise and judge. They laughed at Jesus' ability to prophesy. Do you remember? Covered his head up, slapped him around and said, "Come on then, prophesy, prophesy, tell us something." He did. He told them that Daniel 7 was coming true in front of their eyes. And they didn't listen. But these men don't actually want Daniel 7. They want to play politics. They want to win the world's way. They like Roman power. They want it for themselves, though, that's all. How many bandits are in this scene? Well, there's a couple of bandits hanging up next to him. There's a whole bunch of them stood down at the bottom laughing about him. You know, in the end, Mark 15, it's not only about Jesus dying, is it? It's about Jerusalem dying. It's about Israel dying. She's going to die. I mean, in Jesus' story of the vineyard that I've mentioned a few times, he said, "If you kill the Son, what do you think the Father will do? Sit at home and twiddle his thumbs and say, 'Oh, that was a bit sad, wasn't it?'" It will not end well, says Jesus. Israel has fatal tendencies, and they're playing out on that mount of execution. It's seen in two more points. The end of the verse, "Those crucified with him also heaped insults on him." Even the bandits mocked Jesus, though later Luke tells us one was saved. And then in verse 33, "At the sixth hour, darkness came." The sun should be rising. People should be feeling warmth on this morning. Instead, they're feeling cold and it's going dark. God, as it were, sinks Jerusalem alive into a grave for 3 hours. And it testifies to her spiritual state and it's chilling. And yet, on the edge of disaster, people still laugh and mock and run away from the truth. There's nothing quite as terrifying as the insanity of the human race. Corporately, collectively, we just commit acts of suicide. 4 years where millions of young men die. 21 years later, the lifespan of a young man from birth to 21, we'd start it all over again. How stupid are we? And people do it individually. You think someone's life is nice and stable and going on, and then it just falls apart because of choices they've made. And you think, what was happening? We human beings were capable of such impressive feats. We improve life in so many ways, and yet for the sake of pride, we then pull it all down, the very things we've made. Empires rise, then destroy themselves. Groups with plenty of opportunity, plenty of resources, crash. Great businessmen making great decisions destroy their businesses. Churches. There are churches who do this. The Lord gives them all kinds of blessings. And 5 years later, you think, what happened to them? What did they do? Because it's all fallen apart. And individuals, like I say, given so much to thrive on in life, money and family or skills or work or whatever it is. And then they make choices which everyone around thinks, that was nuts. It will kill their life. And still they do it. And they can't see it. This is what sin has done to us. Made us insane. The events of our verses testify to this. As all laugh at Jesus on the cross. Graveside humour. Except they miss the point that the grave is theirs. Not his. But we don't stop there, do we? Because there is tremendous hope in these verses. So, part two. Let's talk about the number three, shall we? The number three. Back in chapter 8, middle of Mark's Gospel, very important moment. Jesus' disciples, first time, say to him, "You are the Christ." He says, "Who am I?" They say, "You're the Christ. You're God's anointed one. You've come to be the King." And then he teaches them a process. He says, "I am," but there's a three-part process. Number one, I will suffer and be rejected. Number two, I will die. And then number three, I will rise. That's the shape of my rule. That's the shape of my kingdom. That's what it means for me to be the Christ. Three steps. Become weak, fail, win. Why so? Because it's the path of humility that shows faith in God. Jesus isn't going to trust human strength. He's going to rely totally on his Father, and that will be seen supremely when he's laid in a tomb. It's a path of humility where he will sacrifice his own life to save others, believing that God will make all things right and save those he's going to save. It's the path of humility where love for God and love for neighbour takes priority over everything else. Jesus says to his disciples, "That's the shape of my kingdom. Comes in three. Weakness, failure, success, victory." And the disciples go, "Yeah, don't believe it. I mean, you're just like playing a game with us, aren't you? You don't really mean that. I mean, it's like dramatic effect. But actually, we are going to win, aren't we? You're not going to be dying or anything anytime soon. You don't actually mean that. I mean, it's like those Old Testament prophets, isn't it, who said, doom, doom, and then the Lord changed his mind later on, like Jonah. It's like that, isn't it? That's what's going to happen." Jesus said, "No, I'm going to die." The pattern of three is real. And Mark then weaves that pattern of three into his story. Just before the talk, in Mark chapter 8, Jesus feeds 4,000 people. What's said about them? They've been with him 3 days, and they have no food, and they may collapse when they go home. Now, earlier, he fed 5,000. It looked like an army. Well, he got rid of them. But this 4,000 looked like a disaster waiting to happen. Weakness. Why are we told that second story? It reflects the pattern of three that Jesus is describing. His kingdom isn't going to be like the 5,000. He's got rid of the human army. His kingdom is going to be like the 4,000. It's going to look like total disaster. And then he's going to win. Reflects the pattern of three. Look weak, seem to die, receive life. And from then on in Mark, you just find three echoing through his tale. Three disciples see three men on the Mount of Transfiguration. Who are the three? Jesus, Moses, Elijah. Why those three? Well, the latter two, Moses and Elijah, saw Israel suffer and appear to die. And when they left the world, all hope had faded. Remember Elijah going back to Mount Sinai and going, "Well, I think we've had done with this now. I think we can kill the covenant because it's obviously failed." God said, "Not in my book it hasn't." Grace was raised up again after them. Moses dies outside the promised land, but Joshua takes it. Elijah heads off to heaven in a whirlwind, but Elisha brings remarkable grace into the land. And that pattern comes to fullness with Jesus. Weakness, failure, victory. When he rises from the grave. Jesus tells the three disciples on the mountain. He says to them, "Look, this is the plan. This is how it will play out." They still can't see it though. They have a discussion about, "I wonder what he means by rise. We should ponder that for a while." Later on the way to Jerusalem, Jesus is asked by James and John, I mentioned it earlier, "Can we be your key men? Can we be the Moses and Elijah when you rise in Jerusalem. Can we rise with you? Jesus' reply is, you don't see the pattern. I have to fail first. Still, the number three appears. Chapter 14, Jesus warns Peter, you will deny me three times. Then Jesus prays in abject weakness, fearing the wrath of God in his death on the cross. How many times does he pray? Three times. Disciples sleep through it all, of course. Jesus is arrested, and in court he's accused of saying, what? 3 days to smash the temple. Our chapter 15, you can't escape the pattern of three. Three men die, three groups mock. Slander of 3 days is repeated. Time passes in groups of three. Hour three, hour six, hour nine. Mark weaves the number three into his story. And I think that's because Jesus talks three steps to him being king. Suffering and rejection, death, resurrection. Oh, and how will those occur, by the way? Oh, yes, in 3 days, of course. On the Friday, he suffers as rejected. On the Saturday, he's dead in the tomb. And on the Sunday, he rises. Pattern of three. Jesus spoke about it, and Mark keeps reminding us of it through the story. Actually, I think Jesus kept reminding his disciples. I think Mark's just recording what Jesus taught his disciples. But it's here, flowing through it, because it's how Jesus' kingdom works. And that's what gives us hope. Because I painted a bleak picture of Jerusalem, and I said it's a picture of humanity, and that's really dark. But in the darkness, we have hope. You know, as Jesus dies here, Israel is signing her death warrant. The father's not going to put up with this. I mean, she's dead. He's going to destroy it, and Jesus warned of it anyway. Chapter 13, yet it's described her being killed. But not yet, because some will come through to salvation with Jesus. Though Israel dies, some will gain the resurrection, be part of his resurrection. Israel, in a different form, will be resurrected. When Jesus rises, a new Israel will rise with him, his people. The old one has to die, but the resurrection one will live forever. Through her long history, Israel suffered greatly for sins. Then in the first century, when Jesus and then the Holy Spirit had done their work, Israel died. The temple went forever. But out of the corpse came a new Israel. A kingdom which Jesus rules today from heaven for God. Filled with his people who make up the church on earth and in heaven. It came about through the pattern of three. In his life, and in fact has become the pattern of three in Israel's life. And it gives such joyful hope to us. No matter how awful a situation looks, no matter how lost everything seems, no matter how grim and dark and without salvation it is, that's the cross. And then we remember God's pattern of three and we smile. Yeah, there's weakness. There's death. Then there's resurrection. It's happened with Christian churches all through history and with individual lives whom the Lord has saved. Churches have suffered, been rejected, all seemed lost. Churches looked dead, and then God raised her again. Happened first in Israel. In 42 days' time, many in Jerusalem will come to Christ on the day of Pentecost, be baptized and come into his kingdom. Life from the dead. God will do it here. It's what he's done ever since the beginning of the world. He did it at the beginning of the world, actually, because he had this dark lump of stuff and it looked dead. And then he put light into it. He brought it to life. If we humbly trust God, we get to see wonderful things. But the pattern of three is the shape of receiving them. We suffer pain and rejection. We feel all is lost and dead. And then God steps in with power and thrills our souls. The pattern of three is our pattern. And so as Christians, we should take heart. The call on us now is to carry a cross like the Saviour, suffering, rejection, death. You know, when you're given pain to bear, whatever sort of pain it is, see it as from the Lord. When it feels as though people are rejecting you and life is failing, see it as from the Lord. Humbly accept the cross he gives. Know it may get worse. You may live through events which leave you feeling dead. Not physically, but just in yourself. Some part of your life looks like a corpse. And it will never change, because corpses are corpses. She, he will never be different. And then you get on your knees and you call on God and say, pattern of three. Failure, death. Now you bring life. Pray believing that he will in some way. Jesus taught us the pattern of three, tells us all will be well in the end. Let's trust him that it will be so. This is the day of resurrection. This is the Lord's day. Amen.